great to see you on this last Monday in August for the weekly start of CNN Student News. I'm Carl Azus, saying hello from the CNN Center in Atlanta, Georgia. We know some of you are just now returning from time off this summer. Thank you for logging on. First story today takes us to the southern European nation of Italy. A powerful earthquake struck there last week, its epicenter in the central part of the country. It killed at least 281 people, most of them in a historic city named Amatrice. Many people are still missing, and more than 2,000 are huddling in camps because entire villages in the area were flattened. Along with volcanic eruptions and avalanches, deadly earthquakes are relatively common in Italy. In addition to the toll they take on human life, they destroy heritage as well. The historic buildings that attract tourists are particularly vulnerable, in large part because of their age and antique construction. In his prayers on Sunday, Pope Francis said that the quick way in which authorities, volunteers, and civil staff were responding shows how important working together is in overcoming these events. Fred Pleitgen is there with a first-hand look at how and why the Italians' response is so fast.
The catastrophic earthquake in central Italy had a devastating effect on many of the towns here in this region. And it's really the thing that makes these towns so beautiful that caused this earthquake to have an even worse impact. These towns are ancient. Many of the buildings are more than 1,000 years old. They were built before there were even bricks. They're made of stone and they're made of mud. And when the earthquake hit, and it was a magnitude 6.2, these buildings just fell together and crumbled. The response to this disaster was very quick. The Italians very quickly mobilized over a dozen agencies to get over here as fast as possible, including the military, various fire departments, the police, the civil protection force, and of course, local authorities as well. They moved in very fast, they moved in heavy equipment very fast, and they moved in important assets, like for instance, sniffer dogs, that are key in the first couple of hours to trying to find people who may have survived the initial shocks of this earthquake. The Italians have a very mountainous countries. There's a lot of hills, there's a lot of big mountain ranges, and so the rescue crews here have a lot of experience in getting up into remote areas like this one. They know how to build bridges. They know, for instance, how to maneuver in very difficult terrain. The rescue response is probably very different than it would be in the United States. In the U.S., in the initial stages, you would have state authorities, you would have the local police, you would have a local fire department. It would take much longer for the federal authorities, for instance, for the National Guard to move in. Here, that response is a lot quicker because Italy, of course, is a much smaller country, but also their disaster plans call for mobilizing the army, for instance, much quicker.
It was 11 years ago today that Hurricane Katrina made landfall on the U.S. Gulf Coast. Its effects were devastating. In Waveland, Mississippi, what's been called ground zero for the storm, more than 90% of homes were destroyed. Louisiana and Mississippi bore the brunt of the damage. The U.S. government estimates that Katrina was the costliest hurricane in American history. It was responsible for $108 billion in damage. And though it was not America's deadliest storm, Katrina still killed more than 1,800 people across five states, and it displaced more than 1 million. At one point, 10,000 people took shelter in the New Orleans Superdome. The football stadium itself was damaged in the storm. But for those from the surrounding area, these were desperate times.
Katrina formed on Wednesday, August 24th, 2005.
Here's the storm as it moves on up.
It was just a tropical storm at first off the coast of Florida, but the next day it strengthened to a Category 1 hurricane.
Yesterday I signed a disaster declaration for the state of Louisiana. And this morning I signed a disaster declaration for the state of Mississippi.
By Saturday, Katrina had doubled in size and was now a Category 3 storm, a major hurricane. And on Sunday morning, August 28th, Katrina had strengthened to a Category 4, with New Orleans right in its path.
Every person is hereby ordered to immediately evacuate the city of New Orleans.
That same day, the National Weather Service issued one of its strongest warnings ever. Persons, pets, and livestock exposed to the winds will face certain death if struck. Roads jammed as thousands tried to make it out of the city, but the storm veered and New Orleans was spared a direct hit. Everything seemed okay until later that night, when water started toppling over the levees.
When's this thing supposed to stop?
By 7 a.m. the next morning, the city is flooding. But New Orleans isn't alone. Biloxi and Gulfport, Mississippi are slammed by Katrina's front right quadrant.
Who was at your house with you?
My wife.
Where is she now?
Can't find her body. She gone.
Tuesday, August 30th, Katrina has weakened into a heavy storm over Tennessee. But New Orleans continues to flood from breaks in its levees. Hundreds of thousands are suddenly homeless. And it would be weeks before the waters finally went down.
Commercial airline flights are resuming between the U.S. and Cuba. Why is that significant? Because it's the first time in 55 years that has happened. The relationship between the two countries froze during the Cold War. Since 1960, the U.S. had embargoes, restrictions on Cuba, that prevented Americans from doing business or traveling there. One reason, Cuba's government took over U.S.-owned property in 1960. Another, Cuba was supported by the Soviet Union, America's rival during the Cold War. But that support collapsed when the Soviet Union did in the early 1990s. And in 2014, President Obama announced he was working toward normalizing relations with Cuba. It was a controversial decision. Many supporters agreed with the U.S. president that decades of isolating Cuba hadn't worked to change the country. But many opponents of the decision said Cuba's government should have improved its human rights record, its treatment of people, before the U.S. moved to improve relations. In any case, 20 daily flights are planned between U.S. airports and the Cuban capital of Havana. There's expected to be more demand than supply. Many of those who will travel there will likely be visiting family and friends. And though Americans can't officially go there as tourists, that would require approval from Congress. There are other ways they'll be able to board a plane bound for Cuban soil.
After more than 50 years, the United States and Cuba are reestablishing direct flight service. So what do you need to know before traveling to the only communist-run country in the Western Hemisphere? Probably a lot, because traveling to Cuba is unlike just about any other country in the world. For starters, there remains a U.S. economic embargo on Cuba, and it remains illegal for Americans to visit Cuba as tourists. But there are 12 authorized categories of travel. So when you go to the airport in the U.S., before they let you on the flight to Cuba, you will need to sign an affidavit stating that your trip to Cuba is meant to improve U.S.-Cuban relations, and you're not just coming for the beaches. When you get to Cuba, you'll probably find that your U.S. cell phones and credit cards don't work, at least not yet. So be prepared to be off the grid somewhat and bring a lot of cash. Because of the increase in visitors to Cuba, there's a lot of strain on Cuba's aging infrastructure, and hotel rooms are booked for months in advance. So are rental cars. The good news is that Cubans are increasingly renting out their homes and their classic cars, which, as it turns out, is a great way for Americans to experience the side of Cuba that, up until now, was just out of reach. Patrick Ottman, CNN Havana.
Our last story today. When he was just a two-month-old baby in Dallas, Texas, he already weighed more than 200 pounds. So officially, he'd well outgrown this inflatable kiddie pool, but come on, who in the world would take it away? An African elephant calf at the Dallas Zoo played in a pool for the first time last month. Temperatures were in the high 90s then, so it wasn't only fun, it was a way for him to cool down. He was named Ajabu, which means amazing and extraordinary, and somehow more fitting than something like, say, Phelps. The little calf trumpeted his enthusiasm. He put on quite a trunk show, and though he'll pachyderm on more pounds than that pool can handle, they'll move him to a pond when he's up to the tusk, and that way he'll stay in the swim. I'm Carl Azuz with some elephantastic puns for CNN Student News. We'll see you tomorrow.